Good afternoon. So last time we talked about this idea of kernel mode and user mode. So we mentioned that we wanted to have some hardware mechanism to enforce the kind of restrictions OSs like to place on applications, and we had a bunch of options for doing it. But what we settled on was that the hardware would restrict all sorts of operations to just the OS code, and when applications wanted to do those operations, if they were allowed to, they'd do them by making a request of the OS through this mechanism we call the system call, and the OS would do it for them. And to enforce this in the hardware kind of tracks which mode we're currently running instructions in. And we have this kind of one-bit register that either says we're in what's called kernel mode or what's called user mode. And in kernel mode, we have access to the full hardware interface with all the possibly dangerous functionality like accessing hard drives and some other things we'll learn about later. And in user mode, we have this more limited interface. And the idea is the OS is going to set things up so normal programs run in user mode, and the hardware is going to provide a mechanism where those programs running in user mode can make a request of the OS called the system call. And when they make that request, the hardware will start running in kernel mode, but at a place that's specified by the OS. And this means that the user program can only do the things that code that the OS put there allows it to do, and that's where things like our permissions on files are going to be enforced. That code is going to let them open files, but it always checks, are you actually allowed to do it before doing that? And therefore, the program should have no way of opening a file they're not allowed to. And we mentioned that we had this underlying low-level mechanism where we had some special instruction, but if we're writing C code, we can't actually write that instruction. So we saw these system call wrappers, that were just these functions that only made a system call. And we also have a lot of other library functions that incidentally need to make system calls that maybe do it less directly. So malloc probably needs to make a system call to allocate memory, but it isn't like there's a system call malloc. Malloc just makes system calls as it needs to do its job of giving you some memory. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay. And last time we finished off by mentioning that there's this tool called strace, which can, sort of debugging, show us on Linux what system calls a program makes. And we saw that with our sort of assembly program we started with, where I manually wrote the syscall instruction. It's pretty straightforward. We see the syscall for write and exit that I talked about. If we take a program that uses the standard library, we see the standard library actually does a lot of extra stuff. So we have here, we have these calls to break. You might wonder, what's that? That's a system call for allocating space on the heap. So the library internally needs space on the heap. We have this call to this thing called ARC, architecture process control, and that's setting up something for threading, which we might allude to later. We have a call to this uname system call, which is retrieving sort of what is the host name, what OS are we on exactly. We have this call to readlink, which is getting the location of this program, and a bunch of other things that the standard library is doing. But we see we have this puts, and that seems to somehow eventually turn into a system call to write. That somewhere in the puts function, it eventually makes a write system call. And also, when our program exits, we make a system call to exit. It turns out we don't use the exit one, but a different one called exit group, just because that's what they wrote in the standard library. But that we see that too with our sort of normal program. And this is actually a statically linked program. If we take a dynamically linked one, I mentioned, when we run a dynamically linked program, it loads the libraries. And it turns out that we can actually see that in the system calls it makes. So in this case, our program that we dynamically linked actually asked the OS, hey, please load the libc library, open the libc library for me. And after opening it, it like reads from it and actually loads it. That's like it's actually making a request. That's not like something that's built into the kernel. It's something that the compiler puts in your executable and happens when it runs. And something I'd like to note that comes up here, just to emphasize, is that we showed like system call wrappers, but also we have kind of, you know, these functions that aren't system call wrappers like putS. So putS just says, put some characters to the screen. And that's probably implemented by calling the write system call, but it's not like a one-to-one thing. And maybe a more obvious example of where that happens is like printf. So printf is probably implemented using that same write system call, but that doesn't mean every time you call printf, write is called exactly once. Printf could call write fewer or more times. And also, printf is doing a bunch of work that the kernel is not doing in any system call, like converting floating point numbers to strings, right? That's probably not a system call. That's probably just something that library code does. And similar is true of like malloc. So malloc, if you look at your program, yes, allocating memory requires system calls, but malloc will do things like allocate a bunch of memory and give it to you across multiple malloc calls. So it's not like malloc is not a system call wrapper. It's doing a bunch of work using the system calls to handle the part it can't do itself of getting your program more memory. And that's unlike the system call wrappers we saw, where the function only made a request of the OS. The more common library functions you do, kind of, yes, they make requests of the OS, but they're doing kind of extra bookkeeping and other work generally to make those requests sort of more efficient, or, you know, have an easier format for you than what the OS expects. But yes, sorry.
So for the function that calls syscall, does all the function do is it just setting all the register values before doing the syscall, and whenever it's calling syscall, it's always the same function?
Question: for these functions that call syscall, are they just setting the register values before the syscall and calling the same function? So I guess we talked about kind of two classes of functions, right? We have these system call wrappers where all they exist to do is make a system call. And those functions are basically just setting the registers and running the special instruction, pretty much. We also have these functions that happen to use system calls. And those are probably doing a lot of other processing because their goal is to do what the function says it does. So like printf is to print some output, and you don't really care how. So printf is gonna use whatever set of system calls it thinks makes sense. It might use multiple. It might figure out how to do it without system calls all the time. So its job is not to like make a particular system call for you. Does that answer your question?
I guess a better phrasing of my question is that the way you determine what you want from that system call is just setting other register values, right?
Question, the way we determine what we want from a system call is setting register value? Yes. And in this sense, it's analogous to a function call, right? The way you tell a function call what you want is by setting some registers, the arguments, and the function's gonna read those registers. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so this gives us kind of our actual picture of how you write applications. So you write these applications on top of kind of the user mode hardware interface, like our move instructions and our add and multiply, all the instructions you usually use in assembly, and library functions. And those library functions, well, they can't get at things like I/O and allocating memory, so they're gonna use the system call interface to actually implement that for you. Okay, so that's about system calls. So we're gonna talk about some other things related to the kernel. And one of these is with memory. So let's say I write some assembly for these two programs. And in program A, I have a global variable, which I've located at address 10000, which has an initial value of 4.2. And at some point later, I retrieve the value of that variable. If you remember AT&T syntax, this is going to read from memory at address 10000 and copy the value into REX. And let's say I'm running this as one program on my system. At the same time, I'm running this second program, and I have it take the value 99, put it in REX, and then take that value, which is going to be 99, and move it into that same address. Okay. So let's say I just run these two programs at the same time, you know, and I arrange for it sort of while A is working here, that program B runs. What do we expect the value of REX and A to be when this happens? Give you a minute to decide, check amongst yourselves what you think. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A? B? Okay, C? D? Okay. E? And F? Okay, no clue? Okay, so bunch of clues, and otherwise kind of our most popular is that it depends. Followed by probably 42 and 99 as the only possibilities. So I probably made it give you enough information. So if you run this on Portal, the answer is going to be always 42. So this is always 42 always on the OSs we're used to. So there are some OSs. Some OSs where we'd get 99. But that is but those OSs are not any of the OSs you are used to using on phones, laptops, desktops. Those are kind of much more limited OSs. And if you think of why, let's think of Portal. And let's say program A is your text editor, and program B is the crappy C program that segfaults all the time that I'm writing. You would be pretty disappointed if my crappy C program broke a value in your text editor. And so we don't want that to be possible. And so we're going to prevent that in some way in kind of the operating systems that you are used to. So while there are OSs which shouldn't do this, typically we have what's known as memory protection. And basically the idea is that if we have two different programs, you know, they have their own vision of what's in memory, and you know, program A thinks it has certain code here, and program B thinks it has certain code at the same address, but whenever they're running, they see different things there. So we're going to allow each program to have kind of its own vision of what's in memory. That's going to be different for each program, even though the addresses happen to be numerically the same. And we're going to talk a lot more detail about how this is implemented, but the level we're going to go to today is that kind of the main trick that makes this possible is something called address translation. So a simple way of doing this would be that when the OS is running program A, we load memory so it looks like the program A layout, and then when we switch to program B, we unload everything from memory and load the program B layout. We could do that. That's very inefficient. So instead, we're going to have this idea known as address translation, which is going to create what we call an address space. And this gives programs kind of the illusion that they have their own memory, even though really they're sharing all the memory with a bunch of other programs that are running. So this trick is going to be address translation, that whenever program A accesses an address, like reading or writing from 0x10000, that is not actually going to be used directly by the processor. Instead, the processor is going to use this mapping that the OS has set up in advance to determine what that address actually means. And the same thing is going to be true for program B. And what the OS is going to do is it's going to make sure before it runs program A, the program A mapping is in place. Be sure it runs program B, the program B mapping is in place. And this means that as long as the OS sets this mapping correctly, program A can never interfere with program B. Some questions about this picture? Yes?
So what is the OS mapping between? The address that it thinks it has and then the actual memory?
So the question is the OS mapping between the address it thinks it has and the actual memory address? Yes, exactly right. Yeah? Question, why is it 42 always? So in our example, basically program A is going to access address 10,000, and that's going to go through this mapping here, and it's going to end up somewhere in this program A's data in the real memory. When program B accesses that same mapping, it's not going to end up there. It's going to maybe it ends up somewhere in program B's data, or maybe it ends up somewhere in program B's code, or maybe it doesn't have a mapping. Either way, because the OS didn't give program B any sort of anything in the mapping that points to program A stuff, any address program B tries to use won't access that program A data.
So you mean the address that program A used will never be used by program B, and program B will be somewhere else?
So the question is, the address that program A used will never be used by program B? Yeah. The memory that address corresponds to will never be used by program B, assuming the OS sets the mapping in the correct way. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Is the OS mapping only set when both programs are running simultaneously?
Question is, the OS mapping only set when both programs are running simultaneously? No. So because we want to give you the same layout all the time, this is how we always run programs on kind of the OSs you're used to. They'll always have the mapping set up, even if they're the only program on the system. Yes?
Are the registers also mapped differently?
Question, are the registers also mapped differently? No. Generally, no. Instead, the OS will save copies of the registers, which we'll talk about later. So I mentioned that we couldn't do the trick for memory of like copying all of memory somewhere and then restoring it, but we can do that for the registers, and that's in fact what we will do. Yes?
So
Question, is it bad practice to map such that program A and B would access the same spots in memory? It is not, as long as you're doing it intentionally. And on modern OSs, that in fact does happen. So an example is that if we have the C library, it'd be really nice if we only had one copy of the C library loaded. And we can, in fact, achieve that. Now, there are some details with this that we have to deal with that we'll talk about later, like how do we make sure if they both access the same memory, they can't like interfere with each other, but there are ways of doing that that we'll talk about later. Another case that comes up is that if two programs want to actually share memory, there's usually a way you can ask the OS, please let me share memory with this other program, basically. And we'll in fact do that in a lab next week. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So what exactly is the mapping set? Is it when the process starts on your OS that it like sets that mapping, or is it like beforehand? Or
question, when is the mapping set? The mapping is set as is part of the part of starting your process, yes. Or switching to it. Yes?
So when a program that you're running set calls is trying to access memory doesn't have like access to from the OS, so does that occur after that address you're trying to access is mapped by the OS and it realizes it's not the program data or code that you're using?
So the question is, how does this work with set calls? And that is, in fact, the next slide. So something you might notice in my picture of the program memory is I have like these big regions that like don't map to anything. And basically, part of the mapping will say some addresses should trigger an error. And that error is sometimes reflected as what you see as a segmentation fault message. And we'll talk about what does it mean to trigger an error, like as far as what the hardware is doing later very explicitly. Does that answer your question for now? Other questions? So the OS can make sure that the parts of this mapping that don't make sense trigger an error. And we'll talk more about this, what the form this mapping takes on most systems later, which is something called virtual memory. So there's actually multiple ways we can implement this mapping, but by far the most common today is a design called virtual memory, where the mapping is something called a page table. And we'll talk about context switches later, which will make that forward reference I should remove make sense. And I mentioned that, we can explicitly share memory if we want to, so that is in fact a thing we can do. So if we can ask the OS to set up the mapping so there is actually memory in common, and we will do that on the lab sort of coming up, and kind of on Linux, this is a way you can do that. You can make a request to do that. We have the code in the lab for you to use. Yes? So question, if they both map to the same place in shared memory, how would that situation work? Then one program would see modifications made by the other and vice versa, assuming they're allowed to modify it. So I guess something else that comes up with this mapping is we can also have annotations in this mapping that indicate that restrict the types of accesses you can do with this mapping. We'll talk more in detail about those later. Kind of the most relevant for us is that, well, we have to have kind of the OS's data loaded in memory and available through this mapping, and we can in fact do that, but we can sort of mark parts of the mapping as kernel mode only. So we can make this mapping, sort of parts of this mapping only work in kernel mode, and this is important for allowing us to have the OS data kind of available, but not let programs access it. And the way that's going to work is that when the processor does the mapping, it checks, am I in user mode? If so, and the mapping says kernel mode only, just do that trigger error thing. We'll talk about what form that takes in page table and virtual memory when we talk about virtual memory. And so we've seen this notion of triggering an error. So I'm going to talk more about what that looks like. Before I go on, questions about the mapping sort of address translation idea. Okay, so we have this idea that sort of the mapping says to trigger an error and that causes a seg fault. So what is the processor actually doing to make that happen? And you know, if we think of what happens specifically in a seg fault, when you're, if you're running in the terminal, some other program, the thing that's running your program, is informed and gets to display a message. So we want the processor to start running another program. And the hardware somehow has to do this. And the hardware, well, we generally aren't going to actually tell the hardware about all the programs on the system. It's not going to, you know, that's going to vary how that works between OSs. So the hardware is actually not going to have this intelligence. So instead, the hardware is going to run some designated OS routine to handle this programmed access memory that you told me to trigger an error on. And you might think, this sounds an awful lot like a system call, except it's not being requested. And that's exactly how the hardware is going to treat it. So we're going to kind of generalize our system calls to what we'll call exceptions. And it's going to be the same idea as system calls, that at boot, the OS is going to say, here's my handler for this. Run this when this event happens. And rather than the event being the program ran the system call instruction, one of the events could be the program access memory you told me not to let it access. So it's the same mechanism as the system calls, that when some event happens that needs the OS, we're going to run an OS specified function in kernel mode. The OS specified that at boot, and because the OS specified it, it can control everything that happens and make sure that function doesn't do anything bad. So questions? This side. Yes. Question, the only difference between system calls and exceptions is that the OS has decided things. I would say that, so exceptions include system calls and other things that run the OS. They're all types of exceptions. So system calls are just a special case. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we'll start with, so now we have, I mentioned system calls are now a type of exception. An exception is just this hardware event that runs the OS to handle something. So system calls are when the program is intentionally triggering it to ask the OS to do something. And we also see that we can have exceptions from events in programs. And we saw one type was the program access memory it's not supposed to. There's a bunch of others. So if you divide by zero, that typically triggers an exception. An OS routine will run, it's because the processor is basically saying, this program tried to divide by zero, tell me what to do about it, OS. Or if your program does an illegal instruction. Or if your program runs one of those privileged instructions, so you try to talk to the keyboard directly, you're not allowed to do that in user mode, what does the hardware do about that? It triggers an exception, it runs an OS handler for this program tried to talk to the IO device directly in user mode, which is not allowed. What do you want to do about it? And kind of the most obvious case for what the OS would do in these handlers is that it would crash the program and run some other program. That's not the only thing it can do, and we'll talk later when we talk about virtual memory about some very different options, but that's the sort of most obvious thing to do. But whatever the OS is doing, like the hardware doesn't know how to handle it itself, so it needs some help from the OS. Questions? So these categories of exceptions are all what we'll call synchronous. They're things that are triggered by the program that's running. And there are going to be types of exceptions which are asynchronous, meaning they're not triggered by the program that's running. There's something outside the program is causing it. And these are things that we definitely need to run a system like the ones you're used to. And as an illustration of why, let's think of this code here. So here I have a nice little C program. It just runs a while loop. And let's say I run this on Portal. Or the portal machines like have 32 cores, so I run 32 copies of this on portal. we would hope that other people would be able to use the machine while I'm doing that, because it's a shared machine. But if we think of what this, the assembly for this is gonna be, it's gonna be main, jump main. There's nothing in here that's gonna trigger an error. Like, that's perfectly valid code. It's not accessing any memory it's not supposed to. And there's nothing in here that makes a system call. So if I start running this on Portal, it seems like I should get that whole processor forever. But obviously, we hope that doesn't happen, because if it does, I can just log into Portal, one of the Portal nodes, and hog it forever. And it's going to turn out that some exceptions happen even when my program doesn't sort of trigger them. And one way we can observe this is by, instead of writing a loop that does nothing, we can run a loop that ties the time doing nothing. So here, I'm just say, have some code where I get the current time, then get the current time again. And what we'd expect is that it takes some amount of time to fetch the current time. So I see like basically a constant interval between these two. And I run this on my desktop, and here's a plot of the measurements I got on a log scale. So we can see that most of the time, the interval I measured is roughly constant, and it's around, you know, a couple tens of nanoseconds, which is probably about the amount of time to like read the current time. But sometimes I have these outliers which are like milliseconds, many milliseconds. And I have these smaller outliers which are microseconds. So there's two things which are going on here. So one is that somehow other things are happening even though my program's code doesn't contain anything to say run another program right now, run something else right now. And also, some of these take an awful lot of time. A lot of stuff is happening, apparently. So what's causing my program to stop running? And that's going to be another type of exception. So we can have these externally triggered exceptions that are these asynchronous exceptions. And we have different types. So one of the more obvious types, if you think about the infinite loop situation, is that, well, if we have an infinite loop, we need something to stop the infinite loop. And if we want to stop the infinite loop, we want to, you know, not let it run too long. And to support precisely that, the hardware has a timer. So basically, there's a timer the OS can configure. And when the timer expires, that triggers an exception and runs an OS handler for handling. The timer you set earlier expires. So if the OS doesn't want my infinite loop to run forever, which it probably doesn't, it sets up a timer before starting my program and just runs my program, and when that timer expires, it gets to run even if my program hasn't done anything else. We also have these external exceptions for my IO devices. So if I press a key on the keyboard, or let's say data comes in from Wi-Fi, the OS needs to handle that, and we want to handle it promptly. And to support that, the hardware allows these external devices to trigger the OS to run, and the OS specifies a routine to handle like a key press or data coming in from the network, and to handle that potentially right away if it chooses. And we can also have these for things like the hardware is broken, so sometimes hardware can detect certain types of brokenness, and it's going to try to run an OS handler to at least like display an error message about it. But these first two are kind of the most obvious of these asynchronous exceptions. So these are both things where my program is completely unrelated to the reason these events are happening. These are not anything I'm doing. They're just happening, and the OS needs to do stuff while my program is running. Some questions? Some external events. Yes? Question, is the OS set it, have a timer for every program that's running?
Well, how does it know it's a loop compared to like a
Question, how does the OS know it's an infinite loop compared to not? The OS doesn't. Generally, the OS will just choose an amount of time it wants the program to run, at most, and before it starts running the program for a little bit, it will set a timer based on that amount of time. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Is this similar to cooperative multitasking? So we haven't talked about these terms, cooperative multitasking versus the thing that's not cooperative multitasking, which is preemptive multitasking explicitly. So multitasking generally is running multiple programs together. And when we're talking about things like timers, this is actually what's called preemptive multitasking. And the reason why is that it's not cooperative because my program isn't cooperating with it, right? My program has to run with the other programs on the system even though it doesn't want to. So there's something called cooperative multitasking where we don't sort of interrupt these infinite loops. We just rely on the program voluntarily saying, please run another program now, or at least allowing us to run another program. And we'll talk about multitasking more explicitly in a bit. Some other questions? Okay. So, and as I mentioned earlier, these are all types of exceptions. So we have these exceptions, which are just things that run the OS. So we have these system calls are one kind. We have these sort of events and programs, which are called faults. So errors, events and programs, which are called faults. And interrupts, and they're just all kinds of exceptions. And interrupts are sort of the external events. And I have specific terms for these on this slide. Those are the terms I will generally use, but as we'll talk about later, don't worry about memorizing them because everyone differs on what terms to use. So we're not going to test you on the terms because of that. But the important thing is that there's these different causes of exceptions and they're all still exceptions. Okay, so we mentioned that we can have these things happen in the middle program, and one thing that that does is that it gives the OS an opportunity to run other programs. And we see this with kind of our infinite loop. We have these big gaps here. And what's probably happening is that my infinite loop is running. And in between when I'm checking those two times, there's this big gap. And the big gap is probably not that it takes a really long time to move between a value from REX to RVP sometimes. It's probably that a bunch of other programs get to use that processor in the meanwhile. And the reason this is happening, actually, is that it's not that we're switching directly from my program to the other. The OS has to get involved because the processor doesn't really know about what programs are running. The processor just knows how to run instructions and switch between kernel mode and not kernel mode. So we're going to have an exception triggered, you know, which in our example here is probably, you know, from the timer. And that's going to start an OS handler. And the OS handler, in this case, is going to decide, the timer went off. I don't want to keep running this loop program anymore, whatever it's doing. Let's run some other program. And when it finishes handling it, it's going to go back and not keep running the same program. It's going to run a different program. And the OS just has the option to do that. So kind of maybe a more realistic version of our sort of timeline is that my loop program is running, then the operating system runs for a little bit of time and switches to some other program. And then it runs for a little bit of time, switches to another program, and so on. Yes?
So what's the reason of subtracting that from REX? Because I feel like it's more intuitive to add the partial, like temporary result, right?
What's the reason my assembly here subtracts RVP from REX? REX is the return value of get time, so we're taking the last time, last minus first. Yes. Question, is the timer expiring itself an exception? Yes, the timer expiring triggers an exception, and that's why the OS set the timer in the first place. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
Can a user edit the time?
No, so to make this timer work, work on a system like Portal, we need to make sure the timer can only be manipulated in kernel mode. Does that answer your question? Yeah. How long is the timer usually? It does vary, but probably something between like a tenth of a millisecond and 100 milliseconds. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, an exception anytime the OS has to set it? That's a good way of thinking about it, yes. Other questions? Okay, so we've learned that one of the things the OS can do when it gets to run from an exception is that it can decide to switch programs. And so what's happening when the OS actually switches programs? So we learned the OS needs to start running first, and we have this exception, but that's basically calling a function in the OS. Like, if we just call a function, we're still in the same program. So something else needs to happen. So what the OS is going to do to switch programs is first it's going to need to save all the registers in the program counter. So everything basically that was on the processor for this program, we need to save it somewhere, because when we run a different program, we're going to clobber all those values. So you need to remember those values for later. And I mentioned that we have a special case here. Sometimes we switch programs when we never want to switch back, in which case maybe we don't have to save this stuff, but usually we're going to save it. And then we can load some new values and jump to a new program counter for whatever program we're running. Might say, where do we get these new values from, or this new program counter? Well, if the program was running before, we saved them earlier. If the program wasn't running before, well, we have to figure out what the initial values are when we start the program. And this whole process of kind of switching what's on our processor is called a context switch. Yes? Can I explain the restarting the program details? So,
like, as in why it's needed, why that information was lost.
So, question: why do we need to save the registers and so on?
Right.
So, if we think of when the exception handler starts, like the value registers have values that are from what the program was doing. Like, you know, so like array has some value, and when we go back to that program, array better have the same value, or the program's going to be very confused, especially because this exception that ran the OS might have happened anywhere, because like it was triggered by a key press, I could press a key at any time. So we need to save all those registers for later. And when we run another program, that program's going to want to use R8. It's going to put stuff in R8, and if we don't do extra work, the value of R8 will get corrupted. So for all the registers and also the program counter, kind of where we return to, we need to remember that so we can use it later when we eventually do go back to the program. So if we look at this diagram, right, when we're running SSH and Firefox in here, right, they're going to mess up all the register values. So if Loop needed any of them, we better have saved them, or else they'll probably be corrupted. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
How are we starting the program to fix that? So part of switching back to the program is going to be setting the register values and the program counter based on what we saved earlier. Does that answer your question? Ish? Yeah.
Are we just saving them in memory?
Question, are we just saving them in memory? Yes. Sort of, I have a diagram that like the OS's memory is going to have like a copy of the registers for the program that's not running right now. And the processor is going to have the registers for the program that is running, and when we do this context switch, we're going to kind of just swap them, right? Now the OS will store a copy of the registers for the program that's now not running, while the program that is running will have its own, you know, its values on the CPU. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And I guess something I should have put here but didn't is that we need to save the old registers and program counter and mapping of addresses and reset new registers and program counter and mapping of addresses. So we mentioned that each process has kind of its own address mapping. That's going to be part of what we save and restore. Questions? Yeah. How does the OS prioritize which programs to run at which time? That is a decision with lots of different answers. So there's lots of different choices for, and it depends on what type of system you're using. Sort of, usually there's some sort of compromise between I want every program to run for a fair amount of time and I want to make sure I run programs that the user is waiting on quickly, are usually the kind of the main considerations. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Like, if I'm running, you know, at the program that I run in C, I have some variables that are on stack, and I do a context switch, are those variables that I have on stack, are they just gonna stay where they originally were in memory, and then after that's after like you like restore like mapping and the registers and stuff, and that just kind of picks up where it left off?
Question, if you have variables on the stack, do they just stay where they are and just changing the mapping handles it? Yes. So they're going to stay in the same memory location and you know, they'll still be there. If I have a pointer to the stack that we're going to save and restore because that's a register. And when I access that after the mapping's restored, it will access those values. Yes. Question, is it possible to set a lot of environment variables and pollute the OS memory? So you learned about environment variables, these key value pairs that are tracked with your process. And you were under the impression they're kind of in the OS's memory. To the extent that they are still per program isolated data that won't affect other programs. Does that answer your question?
I didn't really get it.
Environment variables, even though they seem like they're tracked by the OS, are basically in your program's memory on every system I know of. So they're basically global variables. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So when we do this context switching, where we're running one thing and we switch to another thing, you know, we get this idea we call a thread. So I said an address space was the illusion of having our own memory. A thread is the illusion of having our own processor. And doing this context switch idea gives us the illusion we have our own processor, because we have our own register values and our own program counter. Why do we have our own? Well, because when we're running, our values are on the processor. And when we're not running, our values are saved somewhere else, so we'll have the same values back when we start running again. So we see that, you know, this context switch idea kind of gives us this idea of threads. They're kind of virtual processors, but we can have many, many of them that are actually on one processor by having them take turns in what we call time multiplexing, which you may have noticed was the label of my slide here. We're sharing the processor over time. Okay. So, questions about definition of threads? Okay, so I mentioned that one cause of exceptions we can have is I/O, like key presses, hard drives, and so on. And kind of the simple notion is, I press a key, that triggers an exception. It's maybe less intuitive. How does this work for, like, if I'm writing a file? Like, what exceptions are involved there? Or how does that happen? So I'm going to go over kind of what the typical pattern of exceptions are with I/O. And something which makes this kind of complicated and people have often have trouble with is that, well, when we're doing input or output, there's a part of it which is triggered by the I/O device and a part of it which is triggered by the application. So system calls are asking the OS to do something. So for example, read a file, right? That's a system call if your program's asking the OS, please read this file for me. But there might be exceptions involved in that because one of the things that will happen is the hard drive will say, you know, tell OS data is ready. Right, if the OS requests data from the hard drive might not be able to give it immediately, so it will trigger an exception when that data is actually ready. And this means that our operation of just reading a file will involve multiple exceptions. You know, a system call to sort of set up the transfer, and one later when the hard drive says, yep, I got the data for you, what do you want to do about it? So kind of, I'll go through kind of the typical patterns. So one thing which happens with like key presses is that often I will have typed something before your program tries to read it. So what might happen is that your program asks to read from the keyboard and, well, before your program did that, the OS said, hey, I have some key presses for you, and the OS actually saved them before your program even asked for it. Then later on, your program makes this system call to request input, and the OS just says, oh, here you are, because it already had that input earlier. Of course, that's not always the case. Sometimes you ask to read from the keyboard, and I haven't typed really fast ahead of your program. In which case, kind of typically what happens is that your program will make that same system call saying, please, I'd like to get some input from the keyboard, and the OS will say, okay, I don't have the input now, and I know you're waiting for that input, so let me do something else until I actually get input. And typically, if there's something else to run, it will context switch to some other program. And then eventually, the device will say, oh, I have a key press now. The OS will retrieve that input, and then the OS will save it somewhere, and it can decide if it wants to run your program now that it's able to run, or maybe it could wait until later to do that. Kind of, so questions about these kind of two patterns for input handling with exceptions? Yeah.
Does the OS ever actively ask the device, you know, do you have input? Or does it just kind of wait for the device to say, hey, I have input?
Question, does the OS ever actively ask the device, do you have input? Or does it wait for the device to say it? It depends on the device and the configuration of the OS. Typically, OSs prefer not to ask actively because that uses processor time to not do something useful unless the device is usually going to say, yes, I have more input. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So these are the patterns with input. And we also actually have kind of similar things happening with output, which is maybe less intuitive. You might think, okay, when we're going to output, I'm going to ask the OS, hey, I'd like to output this. And let's say I'm trying to output to the network. And the OS would just do that, right? But sometimes the device is not ready to accept your data. So for example, on Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi can only send things so fast. So if you ask to output 10 gigabytes to the Wi-Fi, the OS is not going to be able to do that all at once. So what it will often do instead is that you'll ask to output it. The OS will figure out, oh, I can't actually output that right now. And the OS will not actually finish processing that output request until the device triggers an exception saying, now I'm ready for more outputs. So questions about these outputs, sort of this idea of output being delayed until an exception happens. Okay. Okay, so the thing I'd like to go back to that we mentioned earlier. We mentioned this idea of a process, and now we can kind of actually define what a process is. So a process, we talked about this thread, was this illusion of our own CPU, sort of via context switches, switching to share a CPU over time. And this address space was an illusion of our own memory via sort of address translation, which was that map. Sort of program to real address mapping. These together give us what a process we call a process. We talked about with a process. And I have threads with a potential S, because as we'll talk about later in the semester, even though typically so far we've written processes with one thread, meaning that you have one program counter inside of registers, turns out we can write processes which have multiple threads, but they all share the same memory. But when you have multiple threads, basically you have this illusion of a dedicated machine which has multiple processors. But this process idea is kind of this, it looks like when we write a program, we're writing for a machine with its own memory and its own CPUs, rather than writing for a shared machine. And that's what a process is, kind of more formal. So questions about this definition of a process? Yes?
Can you have like as many processes and threads as you want, or is it limited by the hardware?
Question, can you have as many processes and threads as you want, or is it limited by the hardware? So the limitation is the OS, because the OS needs to store the mappings, and it needs to store the registers that it's saving and restoring. So it's going to be limited by the space the OS has to store it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we learned about exceptions and context switches. So I have a bunch of things here. Which of them require an exception? And which of them require a context switch? And I give you a minute or two or three, discuss with your neighbor, see if you agree.
I think it's
Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks, let's start with requiring exceptions. So who thinks A requires an exception? Okay, thinks it does not. Most people, okay. And who thinks B requires an exception? Okay, who thinks C requires an exception? Okay, how about D? Okay, so I guess we have, we're just breaking down what people think. Thinks E requires an exception? E doesn't require an exception? And who thinks F requires an exception? A few people, I think F doesn't. Okay. So I'll start with the ones people are most sure require an exception. So writing a file to disk, I would say yes, exception. And that's because we don't allow things in user mode to talk to the disk, so we have to get the OS involved. The only way we can get the OS to run in kernel mode after our program starts is with an exception happening at some point. Program A going to sleep, letting program B run, I'm going to say, yes, this requires an exception. And the biggest reason why is that we are not allowed to access program B's stuff, so something needs to run in kernel mode to switch to program B and get its stuff. So that's going to be an exception to make that happen. Yes?
Every context switch require an exception, so if you need a context switch,
so question, does every context switch require an exception? So if we're switching between two different processes, we need to run and do that in kernel mode, so that requires an exception to have occurred before. So a common thing people are confused by is that they say, oh, context switching needs an exception to happen, therefore context switch is an exception. That's not how it works. Basically, a context switch is one of the many things we can decide to do after an exception happens. Right, so if a context switch happens, we know an exception must have happened before that, but we don't know exactly what triggered it. Does that answer your question? And I was careful to say a process context switch. So if you look carefully, I talked about threads, which were kind of this virtual CPU, versus processes, which have kind of a CPU and memory. It turns out that we can actually switch between threads without kernel mode. This doesn't happen on the systems that you are used to using today for the most part, but it is possible and it is a thing you will sometimes see. But we're basically going to deal with kind of what happens on Linux, and on Linux, for your typical C programs at least, switching all the context switches happen in kernel mode because they're all kind of special cases of the process context switch. And when we're switching between processes, well, we have to change what memory is accessible. Hope your program is not allowed to access other programs' memory. That must be done by kernel mode. It must be done by the OS. Therefore, an exception had to run the OS to do that. Okay, a program exits, that's going to require an exception. And that's because the OS needs to run to decide what to do now that this program isn't running. And probably it's going to switch and run another program. It's definitely not going to keep running the same program, or else it's not really exiting. So let's go over the other options. So calling a function in the standard library. So something that's confusing about this is that when we call a function in the standard library, sometimes that results in us later, while that function is running, making a system call, which is an exception. But it's definitely not required, and there's some library functions where this is kind of more apparent. So like if we think of like stringlen, there's no reason stringlen needs to ask the OS for help. We can implement that with a loop that looks for that null terminator. Or like, you know, a to I, which converts a string to a number. There's no reason we need to ask the OS for help with that. That's just a thing we can do with code that does calculations, with normal assembly instructions. So there doesn't need to be. Kind of the other reason why is that even those things that, you know, eventually make a system call, it's not calling them that does it. It happens after we call them while they're running. But kind of most directly, it's not needed because there's a lot of standard library functions which never need the OS's help. And Then we have returning from one function to another function. So where this kind of might be confusing is that, oh, you think, oh, like we talked about context switching, like typically involving the OS, and that's kind of related to returning from one function to another. We're like saving and restoring registers, but all the work we're doing for saving and restoring registers and things like that, going from one function to another, that's just sort of normal assembly instructions that change register values. So there's no sort of no need for OS help. S help, this is just sort of normal moves, arithmetic, and sort of flow control. We're just, you know, doing things that we normally do in assembly, not any special instructions that are going to be restricted to just the OS. And the same is true for popping a value from the stack. So you might say, wait a moment, this involves like memory access, but you know, if we're popping a value from the stack, presumably, you know, most likely that value is in that mapping the OS set up for us earlier. So yes, there was some work to set that up earlier, but that's no longer happening when we're actually accessing the value. It was done before, and the processor is just using that mapping to do our pop operation. So, questions about my answers for whether an exception is needed? Okay. So, how about for context switches? So, which of these are going to involve a context switch? Who thinks A? Require a context. B? Okay. C? Okay. D? E? F? Okay, so we have that. We have the answers of C and D for context switches. And that's what I get to. And it happens that in both these cases, the most likely way that that context switch will happen is the program will make a system call, and the OS will look at the parameters of the system call and say, oh, the way I'm going to handle this operation is by running another program. We also learned that system calls aren't the only way time an OS might do a context switch, but in this example, that's the event where the OS runs, and then the OS decides, oh, time to run another program. Yes?
A couple of slides ago, you defined context switches as being from one program to another. If the OS is ending a program, is exiting a program, what is the next program that it's being switched to?
Okay. This question, it simplifies as kind of context switch being went from one program to another. So I guess I'll try to be more careful. A context switch will be from one thread to another, but the thread might be part of different processes. It often will be part of another process. As for if the program exits, the question is, what's the OS switching to? So that obviously depends on what else is running. And generally, if nothing else is running, the OS will have some thread of its own, you know, something of its own to switch to. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
You said that that wouldn't work because there's pre-existing mapping. What if you were pushing a value instead of popping it?
So question, what if I were pushing a value instead of popping it? So if I'm pushing a value, I might be accessing a memory location I've never accessed before. That doesn't mean it's not in my mapping. So the common case will be, even though I've never accessed it before my program started running, the OS set up a mapping where that value is valid. So as we'll learn when we talk about virtual memory in more detail, it will sometimes be the case that that mapping won't be initially valid, in which case, yes, the OS would have to run to fix it up, but that's not going to be the common case and definitely, therefore, not going to be required. And it's good that it's not the common case because if every time we pushed a value that required running the OS, handling an exception probably takes like, 50 to 100 instructions at least. So that would make your program run very slow. That answer your question? Yeah.
So for B, when we're writing a file to a disk, what happens if the parent location happens to be past our current program parent?
So the question, what happens when we're writing a file to disk if the memory location happens to be mapped to our current program's memory? What do you mean by memory location?
So for example, if I'm trying to write something to the disk, but the memory, but the location I'm trying to write happens to be the stack memory that's mapped by the OS.
So the question is, when I'm trying to write, when you say the location I'm trying to write, you mean what you're trying to copy to the disk happens to be part of my memory that's mapped by the OS?
No, so like, I guess, is there a part of disk that you can access without the exception?
Question, is there a part of disk that I can access without the exception? So you're getting into the question of, can I access devices kind of data directly without like going through the OS? And the answer is sometimes yes. We're not gonna talk about how. For the most part, this is not something your program is going to be doing. And it is very much something your program is not going to be doing for the disk, because it turns out to transfer data from the disk to memory is not particularly fast, so we're going to want to copy the data to memory rather than kind of accessing it, quote unquote, directly on the disk. So there, something that might be confusing about this is you might be familiar with ways that the OS lets you access a file as if it's memory. But that's going to be implemented by copying the file to memory temporarily. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So, before I have 2 minutes, so I can go over this. Yeah. So, I mentioned some terms for exceptions, like the word exceptions. And I mentioned that these external events like I/O and timers, those types of exceptions are often called interrupts. And the exceptions like from dividing by zero or accessing memory that's not in that mapping are often called faults. And I'm going to call them faults. And sometimes kind of the category of things that are like system calls where a program deliberately triggers an exception, I would typically call those trips. Unfortunately, the world is not in agreement about these terms. So if you pick up the ARM manual, or the Intel manual, or the RISC-V manual, or the Spark manual, you will see different uses of all of these terms. This is unfortunate. So like, you'll see the Intel manuals call all of these interrupts. You'll see manuals call a bunch of these faults. So if you're actually reading documentation about exceptions and so on, you have to figure out by context, what do they mean when they say fault or exception? Because sometimes they'll write exception and they only mean exceptions triggered by a program doing something it's not supposed to do. And sometimes they'll mean all exceptions. And same thing for interrupts. Sometimes they'll mean any type of exception. Sometimes they'll mean only things triggered by a device. We're not gonna test on the specific terms. I'm gonna use exceptions to mean all of them. I'm giving you this warning because the real world, you know, you'll come across this probably by accident if you ever try to do programming of this type.